I was reading books like The Lean Startup, for example. There was a whole bunch of them, and attending courses. And so what I decided to do is you know, part-time, when I was at CRH, is in the evenings and the weekends, I learned how to code in Xcode. I learned how to build an Apple app, basically. And what that did is that, you know, that piece that helped me understand, like, some of the complexities of coding and how tricky it is, how easy things can go wrong, and how you need to get it done right, basically.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. Today's episode number 84. I'm your host, Roman Zelchenko. I am a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur. I am the co-founder of a company called Laborless, which automates H-1B visa compliance, and also the founder of GMI Rocket, which is a digital marketing agency for the immigration and mobility space, and of course also brings you this show. So today, episode 84, again, it's like every time I do another episode, I'm always like, this is crazy. I cannot believe how many of these amazing conversations I've been lucky enough to have. Our guest today is John Lee, and John Lee is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Work From Anywhere, formerly the Work From Anywhere team. But Work From Anywhere, you know, as you can imagine, if you're listening to this and you're in any way aware of kind of the global workforce and where it is today, especially post COVID-19 pandemic, you know, Work From Anywhere has gone from kind of just a random concept to honestly the way a lot of businesses do their hiring and do their work, and a lot of freelancers work, which is that they travel around the world or they live somewhere else other than where their employer is, and they work remotely. And so, you know, that's really interesting and wonderful, but also brings up a lot of questions and issues and, you know, implications around immigration, you know, tax and compliance and all these things. And so John and the Work From Anywhere team are really kind of focused on tackling this. So I'm excited to get into the conversation about John and his background, and of course, how the Work From Anywhere company was started, and of course, his thoughts on where this whole industry is going, because it's still at the beginning stages. So long introduction, but without any further ado, John, thank you so much for being here. And I'm excited, super excited to like just learn from you today and have this conversation. So thank you.
Well, likewise, Roman, thank you so much for having me. 84 episodes, congrats. That's a huge achievement, huh?
Thank you, sir. It's, you know, blows my mind every time to folks, you know, who have been on the show and who listen. I appreciate you, you know, giving the time. And I always hope these conversations are interesting. And I think today, honestly, is going to be one of those things where, you know, we're not just talking about a company that's, you know, automating a process or something that's been around for a while. We're kind of talking about, you know, a new facet of the global labor, you know, movement that hasn't really existed before. You know, even though the internet's been around for a long time and there's been outsourcing for decades, this concept that individuals can sort of go to various countries and you know, start to be compliant and work kind of on the books, if you will, is really cool. So I'm excited to talk about that. But before we do, a couple of things. Number one, for anyone who's listening, please give us a shout out, or give yourself a shout out rather. Leave a comment below. You know, tell us who you are, where you're kind of listening in from, where you work, etc. Say hello. Obviously, if you have questions for John or myself along the way, please ask and leave that in the comments. And of course, if you like the conversation, you know, give it a thumbs up or a heart or wherever you are watching or listening to this. So John, I mean, I love to always start these conversations, of course, with, you know, background story on the person. You know, we can, and of course, we'll get to where, to Work From Anywhere, but like, who is John? And it's always interesting to find out what that journey is to you know, becoming an entrepreneur. So I know you're in Portugal right now, and by the way, thank you for being on a little bit late, but you are originally from Ireland. Is that right?
I am indeed. I'm from Ireland, from Limerick in Ireland, in the Midwest.
Nice. You're from the Midwest, from the Irish Midwest.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about that, I guess. You know, I don't know, what was it like growing up, big city? I mean, I've never been to Limerick. I've been to Galway, and I've been to Dublin, so.
Fun fact, Limerick is the third biggest English-speaking city in the EU right now, and that's because, obviously, you know, after Brexit, now Ireland is one of the main English-speaking countries, and so Limerick is a small, relatively kind of small town, about 100,000 population. I basically, when I grew up there, I had great memories growing up there. Very strong, family network, great friends, lots of stability there. Really down to earth people in Limerick, I would say. Very big into their sports, and for me, got involved in that side of it. Once the rugby team, you'd see the Limerick hurling team won the All-Ireland hurling for the last couple of years, for example. So,
nice.
You know, for me, overall, very, very proud of where I came from. Those roots, you know, really, for me, very, very important for me. But at the same time, I always had a kind of a thirst for travel from an early age. But for me, Limerick, great memories of growing up there.
Did your, I guess two questions, you know, first, did your family travel a lot or at all, either around the country or ever overseas? When you were young?
They traveled, but really on holidays. It was never for any really extended period of more than maybe 2 or 3 weeks max at a time. But even then, like that was, we were fortunate to be able to do that. You know, we go on maybe 1 or 2 holidays a year. But back then, that was fantastic. We were delighted to be able to do it. I also holidayed a lot in Ireland. But we never really spent any very, very long period of time abroad. But even those snippets when I did get abroad, I loved it. I was always curious about the world. For me, that kind of curiosity found its way into languages then once I got into school, which kind of drove that curiosity for traveling further.
And then I guess my other question, which I like to ask guests, especially about kind of when they're younger, did you either grow up around an entrepreneurial family member or like, were you ever naturally that kid who just like thought about, business before even the concept of business started, we knew about it as kids?
Yeah, I was really interested in business and entrepreneurship, and I kind of like that combination of the this kind of big exciting world that's out there, and on the other hand, then the kind of excitement around entrepreneurship. There were things that really for me I couldn't have naturally gravitated towards, and even though there was no real history of entrepreneurship much in my family, but at the same time you would be entrepreneurs of all walks of life during my time growing up, And I was really, really curious about that. I was also fascinated by the different characters that you'd meet in different types of business. You'd learn so much from them. And for me, I was always, hard to describe it, for me, kind of hearing the stories and the ups and downs, but also the successes of entrepreneurs and solving real world problems. For me, I love that aspect of it. And I just naturally gravitated towards business on the back of that, I guess.
Yeah. And do you remember, like, did you ever start businesses when you were a kid, kind of the quote unquote lemonade stand type of thing or not really?
No, not really. That's not a huge amount, but I did read a lot. I was very interested in reading about different business books and the different entrepreneurs and, reading the Financial Times the Wall Street Journal from a pretty young age. I mean, I would have been like maybe 15, 40 or 50 years of age reading some of those, whereas most people would have thought of you crazy, for example. But I enjoyed that. I just took an eye. Even looking at, for example, when I got into, even like in fifth and sixth year, I was maybe 17 or 18 years of age. I was looking at CNBC and, all the different business news channels and whatnot. It was connected to the world, the bigger world that's out there. And it was a really curiosity about driving. And one of the things I could see is that, take, for example, the global economy. I could see that, for example, in businesses had a very, very big influence on life in general. Mm-hmm. And so the way I looked at it was that, okay, well, if businesses are going to have a big influence on life in general, there's two aspects. First of all, for you as an entrepreneur, you can go and solve real-world problems. But the other side of the game is if you want to try and influence change and make a difference, well, you probably got in some ways a better chance of doing that in some ways if you could do it business. But at the same time, equally important are, the non-business parts of society, massively important. My own dad is a doctor, for example. So, they're also equally important. But for me, I had a hunger for trying to make an impact and also curiosity with traveling around the world as well. And that's where, for me, business was a real opportunity that if you'd have done, for example, law is one thing, you're very much tied to in a lot of ways to one country and a lot of legal systems, for example. You trade up in that system, you've limited ability to travel. But as a business, you can go literally hop on a plane and take, like, look at, for example, online business nowadays today. I mean, look at us here today. Here we are today on the back of the invention of the internet. And so that's one of the things for me. I saw this incredible freedom to go and explore the world from that perspective and solve real world big problems around the world.
That's cool to think about that you were thinking that way as a kid, right? I mean, I'm also kind of imagining, I used to watch like the stock market stuff, in kind of maybe middle school or high school, just because like my dad or my parents were watching that. I don't think I ever thought, so I knew a little bit about it. I didn't think enough into it. And I'm just picturing, you know, you're maybe some friends are talking about the latest sports something or cartoons. And you're like, that's true. But did you see that the S&P 500 is down, you know, and it's like, as a 15-year-old kid, that's really like telling that you're interested genuinely in that kind of
Well, yeah, there was some really deep motivation behind it as well. If you look at it, I mean, I could see that, for example, look at the work that, you know, a nurse or a doctor or a teacher does. It's incredibly, incredibly important. In fact, it's one of the most important things, you know, that anyone could do is, you know, educate all of us that were, give us that gift of education or, you know, save our lives in a hospital. Yeah. But still, in business has an oversized influence, oversized paychecks, but oversized influence on politics, oversized influence on a lot of different sectors of society. So for me, again, I thought, well, look, if I want to go in and try and change things and try and have an influence, so you can, you know, get into business and try and at least understand how they operate. And at least whatever you decide to do after that, you still have plenty of other different paths you can go.
Yeah.
And then plus also the roller coaster of an entrepreneur and trying to challenge yourself and that for me, I was also something that really kind of spoke to me.
So, okay. So you took this interest and you basically, I guess, rolled with it as you went to university. So I know you went to school in Dublin, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And you studied accounting and sort of finance. Then you graduated. Were you thinking at that time, okay, I'm going to go and work at a bank or, you know, do some sort of kind of, you know, work at a large company? Or did you already think to yourself, either this is going to be a stepping stone or, you know, eventually I'm going to run my own business? I may not know what it is now, but I want to eventually start my own business.
No, I was really clear. So I knew, like, I mean, I was absolutely dead certain by the age of like 15 or 16, there was business I wanted to go down to. I basically, from a long way off, identified a course called Business for German, Commerce for German in UCD, University College Dublin. And what I loved about that is you got to learn business and you got to learn, you know, deepen your learning of language, and you got to do Erasmus for a year abroad. So I did that for 4 years. I was abroad jury for a year. During that period, every year, I would have gone regularly every week to these really fascinating entrepreneurial talks in UCD. In the Nova building of UCD. What they had is they had these brilliant entrepreneurs. What was fascinating in every one of them that I went to, because I was trying to figure out, what do I do next? And the problem was, I remember going to one of those talks, all the entrepreneurs who didn't study, at least didn't have an accounting background, they all said how it was really hamstrung them. A number of them who were maybe brilliant visionaries, brilliant salespeople, you know, brilliant innovators, and you know, the problem was, is in many cases, just not knowing how to navigate the banks, the accountants. And I could see it around the same time as well. You could see, for example, going back to General Motors back in the 90s. I mean, essentially, there was a great company and the accountants came in and, you know, these professional managers, for want of a better word, came in and did a fair bit of damage to the company in terms of its ability to innovate and come up with new cars and new ideas. And so I remember seeing that, be really impacted by that at the time. And so, long story short, I said, well, look, what's the best thing to do? And essentially, I looked at the fact that in accountancy, it's like a language of business. Now, there's multiple languages of business, but it's one of the main ones in a lot of ways. And so I said to myself, well, look, I don't want to become an accountant. I have no interest in debits or credits. But at the same time, you know, I might as well get into this and at least learn that language, get a qualification, become a chartered accountant. Then I'll have a master accounting, I'll have a chartered accountancy, and then I can decide what to do from there. And so that's what I did. I basically went from there, did a master's accounting at Harvard Business School for a year that was sponsored by Deloitte, and then spent 3 years in Deloitte, Deloitte & Touche, for 3 years in Dublin. Great memories there. Then went on into the corporate world.
You know, I'm really almost impressed that you kind of heard these talks and what you were, even as you were listening to them, you were looking for kind of problems and try to navigate the information you were getting from them to say, okay, how can I take what they've learned and sort of optimize my experience as somebody who eventually wants to start a business? So, and it's really cool. So I guess, let me ask you this. It kind of sounds like you went into accounting because you heard from entrepreneurs that accounting was one of their big pain points. And I guess the thinking was, well, if, you know, everything else I can figure out, if I can get good at accounting, it won't be my pain point when I eventually start a business because I'll understand it enough, right?
That big time. I mean,
So then my question would be though, were you interested in accounting, or was it kind of like future problem solving by taking accounting now?
Yeah. So what I was doing was looking at understanding accounting like a language of business and using that as a tool that I would be able to have for the rest of my career, basically. And I knew that, you know, finance was going to be one plank of, you know, being a leader in a company that would be helpful to have. So, I mean, if you're dealing with banks, you know, you're dealing with VCs, you're dealing with any kind of investor, you're dealing with understanding your own business. Like finance and, you know, and accounting is one of those things that it's just interconnected cross-functionally to so many different parts of a business. You know, trying to look at a business case, trying to look at a forecast, trying to look at where problems are going wrong, trying to look at if an accountant, you know, or a finance person or another company presents you numbers, can you believe in them? Doing competitive analysis, like all these things, you need to understand the numbers and be analytically orientated and understand what's going on behind the scenes. So for me, that was the logic behind it. Yeah.
That's really cool. It's cool that you found that, you know, that value and you sort of internalized it and kind of and went with it, not just for a bachelor's, but like you said, a master's and then eventually going off into the corporate world. So, you know, I guess it sounds like you were always thinking about business. You were obviously kind of hedging some of the challenges that you've heard other people have by really getting into one of the parts of business that many people don't like, which is the accounting and sort of the numbers. And then you had a pretty long career. I mean, you spent 10 years both at Deloitte and other companies. You know, did you ever think to yourself, like, oh, I'm getting comfortable here, you know, I'm moving up. I guess you worked in the Netherlands, if I understand correctly, right? Like, you were global, you were seeing the world. I mean, did you ever think to yourself, yeah, I could do this for the rest of my life?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what happened was I did the 3 years at Deloitte, which was great. It was like an extension of college. Lots of young people, great fun. Now, you should bear in mind, I was fortunate that I speak a number of languages fluently. So that would be unusual in the accountancy world. So what ended up happening was they ended up sending me economy to clients around the world, like, you know, Diageo and a company called CRH, Ireland's biggest company, a number of different companies, basically, where I ended up doing a lot of work for them all around Europe, which was great. I mean, for me, I absolutely loved that. The mix of travel, I had the, you know, a great life in Dublin. For me, it was the perfect mix. Again, you're getting your chartered accountancy qualification, which will really help you in the rest of your career. And so then what happened was that basically CRH, the work company I did a lot of work for, they bought me out of my contract early. I ended up working with them for 7 years, and 2 years in Dublin and 5 years in the Netherlands. What you don't know, or what you don't see, is that the turbulence that went down behind that. So you've got to bear in mind, the 3 years that I was in Deloitte was, I'm not mistaken, between 2006 and 2009. That was the height of the financial crisis in Ireland. And then we went on to 2 years in CRH in their internal audit head office in Belgrade. What was really interesting about that is that CRH now is a company with like maybe $30 billion sales globally, over 80,000 employees. But at that time, they only had about 100 people in their head office. And internal audit was one of the, you know, the centralized functions that they had there. So there was maybe about 15 of us in internal audit. But the beauty about it was you got to then sit at the table, you know, with the CEO, the CFO, the head of treasury, head of internal audit, whatever it was, all these really, really great leaders. They were all super sharp. I was hugely impressed. And you know, you got nuggets of wisdom and, you know, learnings from them. And I got to see how they think and how they operate. So what happened then is that an opportunity came to go over to the Netherlands. Great opportunity to be the financial controller of the Europe Concrete division. It was like a 1.6 billion euro division. So, you know, to go from an internal audit to being a financial controller of a big division like that, I mean, it's obviously a big step up. Lots of great candidates went for it. And they decided to go for me, I think because maybe I was maybe younger, more malleable, I have no idea. But for me, it was just an amazing, amazing opportunity. And little did I know that the guy I was going to be working for, a guy called Kees Verburg, he was, you know, one of the most experienced executives of CRH in all of Europe. He was there since the very time, the very first acquisition they did in Europe back in the 70s. And so this guy was just incredibly knowledgeable and his values were amazing. He really taught me so much about business. Of course, he taught me, you know, an elite training, Navy SEAL training of you know, how to look at the numbers and analysis and whatnot and business. But he also taught me so much about the values of business, you know, and that was incredibly, incredibly, incredibly lucky at that point. And then, you know, in that 5 years, again, the problem was is that the crisis that hit Ireland migrated to the continent then as soon as I arrived. And so I basically went through eight restructurings over a five-year period. I had five different bosses in a five-year period. And I led some of them. I was part of the finance transformation of some of them. In others, I was the, you know, it was my role being made redundant, for example. So you had to go to immediately then find other roles, you know, losing a lot of great candidates, a lot of great colleagues, for example. And it was really tough because you basically, you know, I started off at Financial Control, the Business Control. Then I was basically the senior finance leader of a 4 billion euro division. But all that period, you're building all these relationships with these different companies. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's another restructuring, things are changing again. But I was very fortunate because, you know, I kept things really fascinating, kept things fresh for me, got exposed to new leaders. My role changed, became more commercial, got to do everything from, you know, investor relations, the basic consolidation, the tax elements, the legal reviews, the country legal reviews, the turning around performance improvement, closing, restructuring businesses, you know, looking at working capital, leading working capital project across Europe. Everything that you could imagine, I was so fortunate to be able to do. And so during that period, if you look at Deloitte and CRH, I visited over 150 locations of CRH across Europe, which is insane. I mean, some of them I visited 20, 30 times. And so I had a choice between, you can imagine, being that a kind of accountant with glasses that receives the numbers in Excel and, you know, sends a few questions back by email and that's it. Or the choice between, okay, getting the numbers, but then seeing what's going on, meeting with people on the ground. And for me, that was my approach. I mean, for me, I wanted to go in and meet people on the ground, you know, for two reasons, to build a relationship and really understand what's going on, but then also deeply understand the business because that would help my business knowledge in the long run as well. Mm-hmm. So kind of a twofold process.
That's also a really positive outlook on a situation where you're going through restructurings and you're, you know, I think a lot of people would be flustered and I'm sure it wasn't easy, but I guess looking back on it, there's always a silver lining, right? Like all the new people that you meet and all the different experiences that you have, there's got to be a positive.
Well, massive. There's huge positives. I mean, all those lessons that I learned and those leaders that I got exposed to, they've, you know, massively helped me in the rest of my career, you know?
So, by the way, which languages do you speak fluently?
Yeah, so obviously fluent English, fluent French and German and Dutch. So those four languages fluently. And then I speak Spanish and Irish as well, but not brilliantly. And then I'm learning Portuguese now as well. So I did these seven probably by the end of next year, and be aiming to be fluent by Portuguese then, basically, yeah.
So we have to do another show where you just teach us how to learn languages.
Yeah. Oh, no, listen, I have it down to a T. I have a whole technique that works for me. And for me, languages, funny enough, languages are my thing. I absolutely adore, you know, learning a new language and using it to connect authentically and deeply with the local people.
Yeah, oh, that's so cool. I feel the same, but I'm not quite there yet. So at this point it's fascinating, right? Because you have this financial background and you're pursuing a career within the financial, profession, but you're also kind of keenly aware of the need of getting other broader business lessons. So you are visiting, sites on the ground, you're working with different executives, you're pulling nuggets of information from them.
Yeah.
Where at this point did you start thinking to yourself, all right, I think it's time for me to launch a business? Because, by the way, Work From Anywhere was not your first business. You left the space and you started another company.
Exactly. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say called Culture Me, but I'm curious, what was going on where you first started to think, I have an, like this, there's an idea and exploring the idea, and then eventually, of course, to obviously leaving a comfort or, you know, at least a secure job.
So basically just before, well, maybe 2 years before I left CRH, I met my wife, Dee, and we met her on her second day in Amsterdam. And 4 months later, we were engaged. So it was pretty action-packed time. We had an amazing time. Then a year later, we got married. A year later, we had our first baby. So there was a lot going on. But essentially what happened was all this time, you've got to bear in mind that I was loving working for CRH, but I get the purpose of going into business was to, you know, become an entrepreneur. And it was a question of timing as to when I would do that. But I mean, of course, I was, you know, going up the different levels in CRH. I was getting all these amazing business lessons. It was an incredible experience that for me, I was fully engaged and was loving it. But then what happened was, is that I remember basically talking to one of my mentors in and CRH, a great guy, Edwin Bauman, and he was the CFO of Europe at the time. And I told him about this. I said, listen, I do want to look at, you know, becoming an entrepreneur. Like, what advice would you have? Because I had this urge inside me that I was getting so much value. I was enjoying CRH, but I still wanted to look at some stage having a crack. I would have regretted not having a good swing for the fence of starting my own business. And he said to me, listen, John, you have a great career for you in CRH here. If you decide to go and stay here, you've got fantastic opportunity. But he said, the age you're at, I think at this stage is maybe, I don't know, maybe 32 or 3. He said, at the age you're at, if you are going to become an entrepreneur, you should look at it sooner rather than later and give it a go. You could always come back. And he could see that I was never going to be fully satisfied unless I give it a go. Because he said to me, look, if you decide to stay here and decide to do it in maybe 5 or 10 years' time, you'll be institutionalized. It'll be much harder. But there's nothing wrong with having a swing for the fence now. And then you can always come back if you want. The low has been opportunity. So that's what I did, basically. My wife, Dee, she founded Culture Me while we were away on a trip to a number of different countries in Africa. We had an amazing time there. But essentially, the concept behind it was actually you have a map to tell you, to help you get to where you're getting to. But when you arrive, off an airplane at a destination in a country, what have you got to really deeply understand the local people? And so the travel industry, the concept behind it was Culture Me, which is basically having an app in your pocket that would do a couple of things. It would use intercultural models, so you compare your culture to the culture you were going to. They would use really interactive down-to-earth culture tips using the local kind of phraseology, idioms, kind of idiomatic phrases and whatnot, or sayings, proverbs. And then what we also had is basically videos, local videos, AI-enabled videos from locals and visitors. So you can see the culture, not just in intercultural data models, but also from videos from locals and visitors, basically. I launched that app. That was a whole journey in itself, and probably a separate, I can have a separate discussion on now. I'm sure you'd probably have some questions, but essentially that was what happened. Essentially, once I decided that, it was a very easy decision, and then jumped into Culture Me.
So I do want to ask those questions, and I'm going to ask a few of them now. So you said that your wife, started to launch it. So was this sort of something she was working on and you were still working at CRH, but you were helping out a little bit with it?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. So what I was doing was I was working at CRH, and then in the evenings and the weekends, I was helping her. And actually, it's really interesting. I mean, if anyone is ever thinking about starting a new business, I would always say, listen, keep that job, that main job that you have, and only jump into a startup when you've really got a good sense of product market fit. We could really see lots of people have great ideas, but are they going to pay for it? So that's basically, that was the reason why I was quite happy. I mean, I was earning a great salary in CRH. She was putting all her time into Culture Me, and I was able to kind of help guide her and help, work with her and help to kind of work through that product market fit validation. So for example, one of the things I did was I basically built a clickable PDF. I designed like in PowerPoint what the app should look like, built a clickable PDF. We use that to test. It's like a free app. You're going to be basically like you could put on your phone, it would behave like a real app, and use that to test the different UX and elements with different people to get a sense of what it was like. But what was quite interesting at the time is that coming from a corporate going into startup, you have a huge kind of a conservative risk mentality that you want to overdo the research, cover every base. Whereas a startup is about just getting in there, launching the damn thing and seeing if it takes off, basically. So, but I learned a lot of lessons from that. I mean, for me, there's a whole journey in Culture Me and a journey of learning from failure that's helped us now in the work from on your team. But that was kind of at that time where we're at.
So how did you know? I mean, you're coming from an accounting background and you're not working for a tech company. I mean, CRH is not, Amazon or Google. How did you learn how to build an app, even though you were building it in PDF? I mean, to put a screen together, to have the best practices, about UX or user experience design, how did you, is it books or courses or, how did you get that knowledge?
So you got to bear in mind through all this time, all the time in Deloitte, all the time in CRH in Dublin and in the Netherlands, I was regularly connecting with other entrepreneurs. I was going to meetups. I was reading a ton of information online, in all sorts of different sources. I was reading books like The Lean Startup, for example. There was a whole bunch of them, and attending courses. And so what I decided to do is you know, part-time when I was at CRH is in the evenings and the weekends, I learned how to code in Xcode. I learned how to build an Apple app, basically. And what that did is that, you know, that piece that helped me understand like some of the complexities of coding and how tricky it is, how easy things can go wrong and how you need to get it done right, basically. And on the UX side, actually going, building the app myself in PowerPoint and difficult PDF and testing it, that was really good from like user research, market validation, and also understanding, that was actually a huge help for us when we did, you know, go to developers and say, this is what we want, because I actually had like a poorly UX designed app, don't get me wrong, but it had a lot of the features. I was able to say, this is what we want, we validated it and to go from there, basically. So that was how we did it. I did it by meetups and reading a ton, basically.
And you know, I appreciate that answer because, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, what was happening at that everyone can see, which was that you're gone and working at CRH and maybe thinking about an idea. The reality is all of your, or not all, but it sounds like a lot of your time outside of the workplace was diligently spent either building up the skills in order to eventually build the technology product or networking with people who've already done that and understanding how you can progress in the right direction and learn from their lessons. So you were spending a lot of time outside of the workplace working on, you know, something. You didn't even know what at the time, but the coding or the meetups, it's like, that takes time. I mean, that's an evening after a long day of work.
Yeah, and I had the hunger for it, though. I mean, this is my, entrepreneurship was always my true calling. And yeah, Getting into the corporates was just about learning about finance, accounting, and about general business and international business as well. I mean, those lessons I learned about international tax and legal elements of it and those aspects, you know, they were also being an expat. Like for me, I was an expat in the Netherlands, like hugely helpful now having gone through that process in different countries and seeing how to navigate it, what the challenges were, you know?
Okay, so you built CultureMe and then eventually you left your full-time job to actually pursue working on CultureMe. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's exactly correct. So what happened was I left CRH and then basically threw myself into CultureMe with Dee. In the meantime, we had our little baby girl, Rosa. Basically for us, what happened was we started off, got a development agency to go and help build the app. The first version of the app was an absolute disaster from start to finish. It was months delayed, poorly executed, poorly project managed, but learned a lot from that and essentially gave the development agency board barrels, and they came back and they did another go at building it. And the version they did a couple months later was brilliant. It was much better. They really took it up a notch. And essentially then what happened is that version of the app, that's the one that started getting all these global awards, like the best travel technology product in the world, the Global Youth Travel Awards in 2018. There was a number of other awards that we got as well. And then in the meantime, what also is happening is we're getting all these fantastic travel accelerators. So we had the Booking.com accelerator, the DC Ryan High Flyers Academy in Dublin is like the top female founded accelerator. The Matsito Travel Incubator over in the US did that one as well. So, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, you're starting to get these double awards. You're getting all these fantastic accelerators and incubators. And then learning about a B2C app, how that was going. And then at the same time, you know, we were still on the journey of like understanding what is the true product market fit. What became clear is that as a B2C app, the cost of acquisition is too high. You're competing against like the Booking.com, Expedia, whatnot. So meanwhile, we were also looking at business travel and we looked at global mobility as well. But we were seeing in business travel that all the research was coming to us that it's a big pain point of business travel, intercultural miscommunication, there were people losing sales deals, there was project challenges between different teams due to intercultural miscommunication. And so we basically started speaking to some of the business travel industry, and that started bringing us towards business travel. But the problem was, is they didn't need another app. They wanted the content, and they want that content distributed via the travel management company. So that meant we just stopped the app and then rebuild it as an API, which was quite interesting because we had to whole learn about how do you build an API. So I had to, you know, speak to my network of different CTOs and tech experts all around the world, researching how do you build an API, basically. I had to go and, you know, get that bit. So that was an interesting pivot in the middle of all that.
So let me ask you this. I think as far as I understand, when you first started CultureMe, it was bootstrapped. You were still working. You guys were just kind of focused on getting it off the ground. Is that right? Or were you? Yeah.
100%. We bootstrapped the whole thing the whole way. So how we did it is obviously, Dee and myself, we had our savings coming into us. We had the serious salary for maybe the first period while Dee was working on it alone, with me only the weekends and the evenings. And then what happened is that it was a really interesting story. So this stage now, I maybe left CRH, about a year. And we had hired Rosa, who was maybe, this stage, she was maybe 6 months old, I think. And it was maybe, July. And basically, Dee said to me, why don't we just sell our house and move to Asia? And we just bought an apartment in Amsterdam about a year previously. And so, loving Amsterdam, just really, and we're having such a great time there. But she said, why don't we just sell our apartment and move to Asia? And within a second, I was like, let's do it. Within a week, we had the house, you know, everything in motion. We had it all sold, tied up and everything by September. Had the flights and everything booked by the end of September. And literally flew out to Asia and spent 6 months living there. To add that as a content to the platform. Meanwhile, then, of course, going through all this pivot as well to the API and everything as well.
Wow. So that was while you were already talking to business travel kind of teams or whatnot and figuring out what to do next.
Yeah, so actually that API that would have been, if I'm not mistaken, around October 2017, if I'm not mistaken, or 2018. And then we came, 2017, I think, and then we came back spent 6 months in Asia and came back to Ireland. And it was in around that time where we really doubled down on that pivot to the business travel space. But essentially what happened is that API, then we launched the API in the middle of 2019. Was delighted with it. It had gone very, very well with the reaction to it. It was back in March 2019 where we launched it at a conference in Miami. Got a great reaction from the business travel industry in both travel management companies and the corporates. And essentially, one of the top three travel management companies in the world, they said, look, we love what you're doing. We're picking up the top three business travel services in the world to pitch this idea in our biannual conference in Miami a couple of months later. In Atlanta it was, sorry. And basically pitched it there in July 2019, got a great reaction to it. It came just close behind the third place, but got a great reaction to it. We got through tech due diligence of that travel management company. And meanwhile, we were also speaking to one of the biggest travel managers, corporate travel managers in the world, and doing also a pilot with a travel management company in the UK. And then essentially what happened is that those discussions, they were progressing really well. And then COVID came along and absolutely wiped it. And that was the end of that. But I learned a lot of really sharp lessons from this. I would say that the concept itself was really innovative. It was needed. It was a very, very powerful tool. It had a huge amount of potentials. But ultimately, it was the wrong channel, the wrong market. Because business travel, which is interesting, is that business travel, who do they report to? They report to finance. So you say to everyone, okay, is intercultural miscommunication costing your business travelers and salespeople a lot of money? Well, they know it is, but they don't measure it. And that's the real trick with it. Because they don't measure, because they're so cost-orientated, the problem is if it's a transactional cost-saving tool, they'll buy it all day in business travel. Global mobility is different, and HR is different. But in business travel, the vast majority are what I would call tactical in business travel. A lot of people in business travel, especially in the US, they don't tend to stay in a corporate travel module for a huge length of period. Now, some companies, that is the case, but in a lot of cases that I could see, they didn't spend a huge amount of time, and they typically reported to procurement, and they typically didn't have an innovation budget. So obviously, I know that now. There were some who were absolutely brilliant people, like, for example, Karen Hutchings of EY. There's wonderful people in business travel like Johnny Thorson, Carly Strachan. There are really brilliant forward thinkers in business travel. But in general, as a channel to go after, as a market or industry, it's a very tricky one on the one hand, on the end user for, let's say, the business travel managers. But separately, the travel management companies, what's also interesting is that the account managers themselves get so little time with their clients that they're extremely limited in bringing in new ideas, new innovation. So you don't tend to see a huge amount of innovation in business travel in the travel industry in general, it tends to lag a lot of other industries, but particularly in business travel. Now, I think that that'll hopefully start to change with maybe the API focus in future in business travel. And there's some great companies like there's plenty of really great companies that are starting to make a really big impact there. But my experience of it is that it's actually a really, really tough market. That's a good time. So we had an idea that wasn't delivering. It was going to deliver a bit of improved business performance and cost savings, but indirectly. And the problem was the companies weren't measuring it. So it was probably just 10 years ahead of its time. But even then, we were still really on the cusp of really significant success. We'd gone through tech due diligence of the second biggest travel management company in the world. We were speaking to a number of big corporate travel managers. And again, just unfortunate how it worked out. But you can imagine, I mean, that was devastating. We'd put in €250,000 into the business ourselves. And that was a really rough moment where, with all that going on with COVID, I was a very, very tough period.
Yeah. Wow. That's so much drama, especially because it feels like everything was moving in the right direction. And I can imagine how the amount of businesses that, were feeling that around 2019 and then sort of the end of 2019, early 2020, there's talks of this thing and then boom, the world shuts down and sort of Q1.
I was actually due to speak in Israel at a huge business travel event where there was going to be hundreds of travel managers and people there. I'd spoken all over the world on the topics and so great opportunities, and all of a sudden COVID, everything shuts down, and it's not just a matter of have you got an innovation budget, it's like, well, can you survive, for the company? So, at that stage then, that took me, that was really tough. We'd been at that stage living with the family at that stage. We had been, as you can imagine, all bootstrapped. For me, I was very deliberate. I knew that once you get one big deal on the board with the API, you're absolutely flying. You'll have no problem raising. But we wanted to wait until we were getting, because we knew we were close. But of course, obviously, after everything that happened, for us, it was very, very tricky. So I needed I needed, 4 to 5 months just to heal my mind, body, heart, and soul, because I had emptied the tank, absolutely emptied the tank. Both Dean and myself had. Then he had a baby, had two babies in the meantime, had Rosa and Esme in the middle of all. And Rosa was, Rosa's our little celebrity. She's like 6 now and she's been to 25 countries. So all of those countries that she probably doesn't even remember, they were all part of that journey of going into these different countries and cultures and exploring the world. And that, those 6 months in Thailand in particular, such a special time. I mean, it really left a huge imprint on all of us.
Wow, that's unbelievable. Did you guys have to, because I want to kind of transition, understand, okay, well, where did the concept of work from anywhere come in? But did you, before we get there, did you sort of shut culture me down, or did you press pause in a way to see what would happen next?
For me, I basically put it into cold storage. One of the things is that I was able to do consultancy from it for culture consultancy and whatnot. I'm actually on the board of CITAR Europa, the Society of Intercultural Trainers and Researchers. So that's a volunteer position. I mean, culture is something I'm deeply passionate about. But for me, put it in cold storage. I'll have a look at it again in maybe 5 or 10 years' time, potentially. Who knows? But I won't put it out of cold storage unless the world is ready for it. And the world of travel at the time, it just wasn't ready for it. That may change. But for me, my sole focus now is the work from anywhere team. Yeah.
So how did that come about? Because I can obviously imagine that, COVID shut the world down. There's this major shift in business. I mean, there were some companies skyrocketed, Zoom, yeah, Peloton, et cetera. Some companies kind of went downhill. Other people were terrified. What's going to happen? Yeah. Is the world ever going to go back to where it was before? And then, of course, this idea of remote employment emerged. So how did you start to connect the dots and think to yourself, all right, there's another opportunity here?
Well, you've got to remember, we had been a digital family for a number of years. So we've been doing it. We've been working remotely all around the world, hiring remotely ourselves and the team at Culture Me. We had been through that process ourselves. So we had a lot of experience from it. What happened then is after, Culture Me had went through those challenges with the COVID, I started doing some consulting myself, finance and technology and strategy consultancy for a couple of years. And that was great for you know, together with Dee. She was working a full-time job. That was helping us get ourselves back on our feet. We had another baby, Barra, in the middle of it all. But essentially what happened was, is about 2 years ago, my co-founder, Dole, he was, you have to remember, I was doing consulting with companies and I could see I was delivering a lot of value and I was seeing either hunger for entrepreneurship. And what happened was, is my co-founder, Donald, he was in, going back to Sydney, and he was put into quarantine, which is very strict. It was like maybe, I think, 7 or 10 days in quarantine, basically in a quarantine hotel. And so what I said to him was, look, why don't we just brainstorm? And we'd always talked about entrepreneurship ourselves for many years. So why don't we just brainstorm an idea just to see if we can come up with an idea? And so what happened was, is he basically, we're talking about like where would the big opportunities be? And we both came to the conclusion that, you know, there'd be this market, what we called at the time, the work from anywhere market. Nobody's really calling it that, but we said, we'll call it the work from anywhere market, where there would be this massive amount of people that would be doing, just like we'd been doing, you know, for a number of years, working remotely abroad, being able to take the laptop and work from, you know, wherever they wanted. So then we said, okay, we looked at our research and said, how big is it going to be? Of course, we had no data. It was COVID. So we only had, we had nothing to go on. But we kind of suspected it would be a big market. And then we said, okay, what would be the challenges with that market? And so he proposed the idea. He said, well, what about the long-term house swaps? That'd be a really interesting idea. And I said, yeah, no, that'd be interesting. But I said, the problem is your, you know, your taxes with the tax residency and some of the payroll triggers. I said, you know, that's going to be a challenge. But as soon as I said it, I was like, hold on a second. There could be a big opportunity here. So we did surveys and yeah, they just confirmed for companies, individuals, that tax was going to be the big pain point. And that's kind of where the genesis of it all kind of started.
It's so interesting to me because when you decided to go into accounting as a student, the reason it sounds like was because you saw that the major kind of common denominator in terms of pain points for all these business, you know, founders, entrepreneurs you heard about from was the tax implication. It was the accounting.
Right.
So in a way, you're kind of this business and the nexus of the idea is exactly your thought process, a parallel to your thought process back when you were just deciding on your concentration in university.
Okay, completely. But where it gets, you know, really deeply fascinating is if you unlock that pain point of tax. If you can solve that for companies, guess what? You actually open up the opportunity to, you know, work from anywhere in as much as it can be done, obviously, with immigration and tax legal, let's say, challenges. But you unlock that opportunity for, you know, tens of millions more people around the world. And for me, the transformational impact that travel has had in my life of experiencing different cultures, you know, you can't buy that, you know, not just for me, but for my kids. You know, Rosa can still do the Thai greeting all these years later. Now, it's left a really deep impact on her and all of us. We went back to Thailand again at Christmas. I cannot emphasize, you know, what a transformative trip that was. Again, just reminding us the beauty, the deep beauty of connecting with other cultures and going to these wonderful countries. And so you can combine that with work, or you can combine it with the flexibility of location, being able to work in so many more different interesting places in the world. That for me is transformational. That's powerful. But again, it starts with solving those challenges that we all know about, which is, you know, the immigration, the tax, the legal challenges, you know?
Okay, so what was the first thing you guys did? All right, you come up with this idea and you say, tax, that's the thing we need to solve in order to allow people to work from anywhere. What did you first build out? How did you get started?
So what we did is we built this tax risk map. It was like really basic. But actually, it was quite interesting. I can share it here if it's easy. But essentially, let me see here. This is the one. Share screen. There we go.
And for anyone who's going to be listening via audio, I'll try to describe it a little bit.
So what you have is this is a simple input form where you've got, in this case, you put in here we are, any country in the world. In this case, you go, let's say your tax residency in Norway. You want to go abroad for, let's say, 60 days. And then you see this map that just comes up, basically, where you have every country in the world, and it's either high risk, medium risk, or low risk. You click on it, and then that tells you then, okay, is there double taxation agreements? What's the residency days? You know, does it have a digital visa? Explains like some of the common employer risks, and then allows you to connect to a tax expert. So you know, the beauty about that was that was a kind of a lead gen for being able to connect with companies and get them coming in, companies, individuals, and understanding what are their real pain points. So basically a simple algorithm that we built. We got a tech company to go, and I done the research on the tech stack. Basically, I could see that it was Skyscanner, I think. Was it Skyscanner? I think it was. Had a really good COVID map, one of the ones. And basically, I said, look, let's just use... I looked at the underlying technology of that and said, look, let's just use that, you know, that approach, but use it differently, but use it for tax. I got a company to go and build it out, basically. And we built the algorithm ourselves. Yep.
And so you, I mean, as somebody who was a controller, as somebody who did, you know, worked in accountancy for many years, did you feel comfortable going in and trying to understand the implications from a tax perspective with in all these countries? Or did you kind of leverage a network of experts around the world to say, hey, you know, answer these questions or whatnot? Like, because it sounds like a lot of work to map that out.
It's a massive amount of work. It's a massive amount of work. But again, in that first version that we had, an algorithm sounds complicated, but it's essentially a database with a bunch of if functions that, okay, when you start off simple, it might be easy, but it can get more complex. But in this case, you know, we use a bunch of basically, first of all, basic data points, like what is the highest income tax rate, for example, like all that stuff is pretty easy. Then looking at digital nomad visas, which are coming in, you know, doing your research on those, and then using basically a bunch of proxy indicators that would give you a reasonable indicator of what the actual tax risk would be, basically, and looking in at, you know, in each, we basically had a subscription to a tax platform, basically, where you could look at the tax legislation. And so what we were doing was is codifying parts of it. So picking relevant bits of it, codifying it, and then putting it into the algorithm, basically. And then it was a limited number of data sets, but it was basically be able to give you a reasonably useful proxy for individual tax residency risk. Again, that's only one component. There's a lot of other risks that we built out further in our later versions of our platforms. But it was good because it got us actually interacting, really told people's pain points on the ground. I knew a lot of the tax and legal risk with corporation tax, payroll tax, and Social Security and beyond. But I think this was, you know, useful to see what were people's pain points. So we did individual employees, contractors, high net worth individuals, you know, large corporates, and you know, the scale ups and startups coming to us as well. So interesting seeing the different, you know, experiences about all those coming into.
So then, okay, you built out this map, you did the research,
yeah.
You hired an outside consultancy or, you know, a tech development firm to build it. I assume that you've been building out contacts through your years of working in corporate and then eventually with CultureMe doing the business travel and speaking at conferences. Did you feel like you had a market to at least go and test this idea out, or maybe even potential clients? Or like, how did you go about, you know, going from idea to some sort of a product to then eventually starting business discussions?
With the product, like the product was, what it was doing was it was taking something that's immensely complex and was trying to take the world of tax and just bring a bit of a different angle of innovation on it to make it, you know, take an aspect and just make it really simple for the user. So tax is tremendously complex. And tax technology tends to be very, very complex. And it should be complex in the back end, but not necessarily in the front end. And so the concept was, is if you can take that and make it easy for people to use. And we knew that this was a pain point. We knew residency was a worry for a lot of companies and individuals. But again, for us, we were kind of open-minded as to where is product market fit going to go. So we launched the product, used all, you know, organic ways to reach out to people, social media, use my contacts, for example, doing direct outreach, for example, things like that, and use that to try and, again, the idea was it's not going to, you know, spend a huge amount of money on marketing. You shouldn't. When you're in product market fit, it should be about research. It should be solving people's problems. But what I did was I used all those conversations to try and actually talk to people about how they could, you know, if I was dealing with a company, I try and say, well, look, here's what I've seen from other companies. Here's how I suspect you can look at solving it. Here's an interesting report here. Here's a trend that I'm seeing here. And it was help those people in, let's say, global mobility in this case, to help kind of use those discussions to try and, you know, to be able to help solve their problems around work from anywhere or, you know, putting together a policy. And so a lot of those conversations, I wasn't actually selling anything. I was really just chatting to them and helping them and building a community. Again, the idea was, is that if I can help a lot of people, I'll obviously be able to get some good feedback. And if and when we do have something to sell to them, I'll have at least some goodwill off the back of it. That was kind of the the idea, but a lot of it was also about trying to figure out where is the market for this? Is it individuals or is it companies? And if so, where, how, what roles? And of course, my experience in Culture Me taught me so much about it, being absolutely bulletproof sure this is the market that you need to be targeting.
So what was the market? Where, you know, now it's been a couple of years since you guys have launched. Can you talk to me a little and everybody about, you know, where you did end up going and sort of how Work From Anywhere works today?
But how it works today is basically a really simple tool. Like if I just click here, share screen, here we go. You can see it. You can log on.
And as you do that, if you don't mind describing it, because just for audio.
Yeah, we'll do, of course. So what it is, it's a platform that companies can go on to. What you have is you click on here, your user profile. You first of all have your company profile where you can actually see, for example, and this is just a demo version of it because basically it's an individual company to put in their weightings accordingly. But essentially, in this case here, you've got your remote work policy. You set how many days that you want to allow, which countries, for example, your global hiring policy, whether you've got any restrictions. But it, crucially, your risk appetite. Your risk appetite, is it low, medium, or high? Like if you're a software technology company trying to hire developers, you might tend to have a little bit of a higher risk. Whereas if you're a bank or whatnot, you might have a lower risk appetite. But again, you can change your risk appetite in those, as well as put in your policy for different countries, for example. And then what happens is that in this, you then basically go in and you click on start search in the main page of this tool. And in that, you're going to see a bunch of different inputs. The first one is, do you want to hire from anywhere or work from anywhere? So hire from anywhere is that I want to hire a role in a different country. Work from anywhere means I want to allow one of my employees temporarily work remotely abroad. So if you go, for example, in hire from anywhere, I want to hire somebody in India, for example. So these are the inputs I'm going through. For example, does it have a legal entity? How many people do you want to hire? How soon are you hiring? We'll take a look at their citizenship in this case, where they're tax resident in. We'll look at the nature of their role. In this case, we're going to hire an engineer. We're going to see if they've got any sales contract signing authority, and if they have the legal right to reside and work in India, basically. So what will happen then is their own proprietary algorithm is working away the back end. And what it's going to do is it's going to spit out the following. It's going to spit out, first of all, a kind of a dashboard where the top of it is going to be with the risk profile of this particular scenario for payroll tax, for social security, for corporation tax, for employment law and contractor classification. And it's going to tell you if there's a double taxation agreement, a social security agreement in place with that country combination. It's also going to tell you what the likely solution is. And that's what's the really important bit. It's going to tell you, is it likely to be a legal entity or an employer record, or a contractor, or a digital nomad visa, for example, if it's work from anywhere. And you'll see an explainer as to what's involved and the estimated savings versus going, let's say, via traditional route of advisors, let's say. So that's basically the concept behind it.
And so if you're looking at the potential solutions, right, how you can actually go about hiring a software developer directly in India, you know, how do you determine whether an EOR, an employer of record, or whether, you know, setting up your own legal entity or something like that? How do you determine which one is better for this particular company?
So it really depends on the scenario. I mean, one of the first things to start with is, you know, what are the countries you likely want to expand it as a company strategically over the next couple of years? But, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is you've got to look at where is the talent you're looking to hire from or allow work from anywhere from. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at it, the case of you want to hire a developer in India, you've got to look at the unique circumstances in that country of whether there are any specific risks that are elevated in a very, very high way. So, for example, one of the ones in India is the risk of parent establishment. They're quite strict about parent establishment in India. And so you've got to be very, very careful. If there's a country is very strict on parent establishment, it will shift the emphasis towards one solution away from another. And that will also depend on the nature of, for example, the activities of the role that that person has. So if somebody has high permanent establishment role, like for example, they're a senior director or in a sales generating role, well then an employer record is not going to be a great option in that case. A lot will also depend on contractor classification in that country as well. So if there's a high risk of contractor classification, well then, you know, particularly if that contractor will just be working for you, it's probably not going to be a great option to hire them as a contractor in that route, particularly if it's going to be for a prolonged period of time. So there's all sorts of different factors which, you know, link to the local tax and employment law legislation, the unique factors of also the circumstances that person is going to be doing, for example, those activities and the nature of the role and beyond, that will then help determine what is the best route. And whether it's to set up a legal entity or go via employer record or a contractor, or if it's temporary work for money, or look at a digital visa, for example.
Yeah, for the countries that have them, of course, and to your point, some right. don't.
Correct.
This might be a little bit of a silly question, but I think that it would be a really important one. How can, and maybe I'm setting up an answer that hopefully will be, you know, helpful. How do people trust that what they see on this dashboard is accurate and up to date? You know, I mean, you have to be aware of the policies, immigration, tax, et cetera, across the yeah. board for so many different countries.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. So on the immigration, you know, we're not a full service immigration platform at all. We focus on tax on Employment Globe, but for the immigration piece, what we did is we integrated it in the IATA thematic API, which allows us just to check, okay, is there a visa and very, very high level, you know, what's required in that perspective. So it's very, very light touch in that piece. That's right. By a real-time API. On the tax piece of it, I mean, luckily, tax legislation doesn't change every single day, at least critical elements for remote work. But I will say, you know, what we do have is, you know, you'll have updates that happen. You know, we get alerts on a regular basis. And what we do is once a month, we'll determine, is it a material update? And then does it have an impact on the algorithm? Do we need to update it, for example? I will say one thing that we do keep an eye on that happens quite a bit is digital nomad visas. There's new ones emerging, or there's updates to digital nomad visas on a regular basis. So they'll need to be updated maybe more frequently. But in general, I mean, tax, let's say a country review, you know, you typically update it once a year. And unless something big material news happens during the year, you know, once a year is fine. And that's, you know, that's the same for typically the largest accounting firms in the world. You know, they do their annual review of the company of the countries as well. But again, luckily the thing is that tax legislation doesn't tend to change very, very regularly. It tends to stay stable year to year, except when there's like a new budget announced or things like that, for example, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, I reflect on immigration, especially during COVID, where every week there's a change of policy, a change of, you know.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And all we're doing in our, in the API with IATA is we're just checking, are they even allowed? Like, is there an ability to even go and work there temporarily if they want to, for example? So you're absolutely right. I think we did actually a bit of visas in Costa Rica. We were doing it the first time. And I of all people, understand how unbelievably complex it is. So we made sure to stay, like, to steer well clear of that, basically. Yeah. But it is important. It is important to check on that, to see, are they even allowed work in that country from a visa perspective? Not a right, necessary right to work. That's a separate question. It's more trickier. Yeah.
Who would be, like, the ideal person to learn about work from anywhere? I mean, is your client the corporate, you know, the global mobility manager? Is your client sort of an immigration law firm that can use your tool to advise their clients? I mean, like, who do you guys go after, and basically who should be checking out the site or the product?
For us, it's very, very clear. Companies that have between 1 and 20,000 employees as a sweet spot, up to 50,000 employees, but between 1 and 20,000 employees, basically, or it's a small global mobility team, or an in-house corporation tax team. Basically, anybody that's involved in their companies of linking through and thinking through the future of talent mobility, they're the people that will find a tool like what we have, you know, very, very interesting. So typically, you know, the people that we deal with are companies in, you know, that have maybe talent mobility or global mobility or in-house corporation tax roles, where they're being, you know, getting all these requests for work from anywhere or hire from anywhere that are coming to their desks, basically. And they know they're familiar with the risks, but they just don't have the time to go through themselves and manually assess these, or, you know, the delay of going to external advisors and waiting, you know, a week or a couple of weeks before you get back an answer. Now you've lost the candidate you're looking to hire, or you want to let somebody temporarily work remotely to in a country, work from anywhere in Spain for a couple of weeks. Can you do it? What's the level of risk? And they need a tool that will visually help them explain to senior execs as well. So it's a combination of that, reducing the automation. So we're using the time by, let's say, through the automation technology that you have, so that just gets that decision quicker as well. And of course, the cost savings is an obvious one as well. But anyway, people in those roles are the sweet spot.
And then are there also opportunities? I mean, you know, do you have partnerships with kind of the RMCs or law firms or something to help you kind of get through to that client?
Yeah, well, yeah. So we don't have any partnerships with RMCs, but we do have tons of partnerships with different tax firms, employers of record. We have, you know, let's say the immigration providers, policy providers as well. So as part of the tool, we introduce you to the relevant local partners. For us, it's very, very important just to introduce to the right partners. You know, we could have looked at using that as a massive, you know, referral revenue generator, but we're like, no, for us, focus all our energies on just having the best tool with the best advice, that, you know, basically with the best user experience. And then if we can introduce to the right advisors, great, fantastic. But for us, you know, our revenue generator is on the tool, basically. Yeah.
And how does that work? Does that, you know, is that global mobility or in-house corporate or tax team? Is it like an annual license or per use? Or I'm just kidding. I'm curious.
Yeah. Annual license, basically. So what we have is basically for, you know, the small to mid-sized company, you're talking about $12,000 a year. That'll allow you to, you know, tweak your policy, put it in it, for example, allow you as many searches as you want for a limited number of users. If you're a larger company, it'll be $20,000 a year, basically. That'll give you as many users as you need. Again, unlimited searches, for example, and also have access to the consultancy piece as well, with even Melda Keane on the team who's the head of the mobility strategy. And then we're also looking at being able to companies to be to buy small batches of searches as well, because that's also something we're seeing. We're seeing companies that can't afford the bigger amount, but they would love to be able to use it for a couple, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, like a per use. You know, that's actually something we learned with Laborless. We launched it as a subscription model, and, you know, we had the opportunity for sort of smaller companies to, but even for the very small companies or law firms to use Laborless, they said, you know, why am I going to pay for a year when I only need it three or four times a year? So we ended up releasing a separate pricing structure that was almost like a per use, or like you said, a batch. And I think that flexibility allows you to help smaller businesses too.
And that's what we want to do as well. And so we haven't targeted law firms or tax firms to use it, but a number have said actually I'd be interested in either using it or being able to resell it or whatnot. And, you know, we're happy to. But the feedback, I have to say, we've been very fortunate. The feedback has been fantastic from the tool. It's been brilliant. We've been bold and we've blown away, but we've been very deliberate. I mean, we deliberately, you know, we spoke to about 50 different companies while we were building it. We were building it with the market, with the whole very senior people in global mobility and tax, to make sure what we were building was serving their needs, basically. And so that was also another lesson as well. We didn't spend, you know, millions on building a real heavy oil tanker of a technology platform. We deliberately chose a platform that was really agile, that would allow us to iterate and tweak and add new features according to what people were looking for. Because part of my lesson about my first startup was that by the time you identify what the features are, by the time they get developed and actually implemented, it could easily be 6 months. If you're like iOS, getting approval to the Apple App Store, that could take you 2 months. Easy alone. By the time you have the app ready to release, but Apple could be weeks coming back to you. So I knew if you could pick a different platform and be really agile at it, then you'd be able to get to market quicker, but also iterate the feedback quicker as well.
Yeah, that's really smart. And you know, when I first started this show, the whole idea for me was talking to people building tech within our industry to learn from them and have other potential entrepreneurs who may want to start a business in the industry learn from people who are building in this space, not building, you know, something in fintech and then have to sort of relate it to mobility or immigration. So that's a really, really good, you know, tidbit of information, especially because I think people do want to build the oil tanker. And they look at success as look at how many tabs I have or how many things my company, my app can do. But sometimes, especially if you're just launching, that could be really overwhelming. You know,
you can launch. You can just look up no code tools. You can launch a website or app in literally a couple of hours. That's the beauty about today. You know, if anyone in global mobility or beyond immigration has an interesting idea, I would say absolutely go for it. And actually, any of the entrepreneurs that are in, you know, the kind of global mobility or remote work or work from your space, I'm always happy. I've chatted and kind of mentored a number of them to say, look, this is what my lessons I've learned, and I'm open, very open in kind of sharing that with people as well. But I think for me, it's fantastic. What's happening now with technology is incredible. It just makes it so much easier to go and launch a really, really great idea.
So as we kind of wrap up here, I'm curious, where do you see, you know, first the business going, you know, work from anywhere as a tool, and then sort of how do you see that maybe as a reflection of, or how do you see that, how do you see the industry, where do you see the industry going from a global work perspective?
So for the company, I've never been more excited in my life. I'm extremely privileged that we've gotten a lot of love from the industry. and a lot of people have been really generous with their time and mentorship and giving us feedback. And my philosophy from day one has been to try and really just help people, have conversations to try and help people. Even back then, like 2 years ago, where I had nothing to offer, but even before then, I had a great network in global mobility coming into it. And so for me, what I really hope with the company is that, you know, we can really, really, really make an impact for this underserved niche of great tools for some big companies. But what about that mid-market of people who are small global mobility, talent mobility, corporation tax teams that are facing these problems, but can't afford, you know, the heavier tools, don't have the budget to go and implement this, or, you know, get in a SAP or Oracle integration, that want something that's, you know, that's quick to go, it's plug and play, that can help us solve the problems. Because for me, if I can help them and make an impact with those companies, I can have, my real vision is I want to be able to give more people access, you know, in a compliant way to the beauty of remote work and what it can do and work from anywhere and hire from anywhere. And that for me is, I'm really excited about that. And what are the second and third degree, you know, consequences of that? When I look at the global mobility industry, what does this all mean? For me, I think the constant echo I'm hearing back again from all these conversations is how this global mobility has never gone through as much change in these last 2 years as it's going through now. And the role of global mobility is fundamentally shifting, which is really exciting. And for me, how I see it is that you have the remote work world and community of experts over here and the global mobility community over here, and they're starting slowly but surely to come together because there wasn't a lot of knowledge of each other's communities before. And I'm really excited to see where does that go and where does the future. I sense that people with global mobility, talent mobility, you know, and they're building the future work right now as we speak of this kind of, you know, not quite borderless world, but they're building this world that's rapidly changing. And what happens from here, I have no idea, but I'm hugely excited. And one of the examples would be like here I am in Portugal. You know, I was in renting a house in Ireland last November. The owner of the house said, I want to move back in. I said, no problem. We looked at moving to other parts of Ireland, but we said, you know what, why don't we look at moving abroad? And looked at every country in the world. Portugal came up number one. And by March, we'd all moved over here. Great school for the kids and have never looked back. And for me, that's exciting because what does that do for, you know, for all of us, all of our people that we're working with and looking at the opportunity that has, the impact has both on us as individuals and also for our kids. So for me, I'm very, very excited about where is that going to go?
That's super, super exciting. And it's also really impressive. Your family is very mobile and kind of, you know, open to, and to your point, look, it's about having an option. Maybe there are people or families that aren't as willing or able or feel comfortable moving like that. But the fact is that we have the choice and we can do it in a way, as you said, compliantly, which is really, really important for a lot of people and companies. So that's, and I guess that's how you're going to be fluent in Portuguese, right? Because now you're going to be spending some time there.
Exactly. No, completely. I think the thing as well I want to add as well, which is really interesting, is the employers of record and digital nomad visas. There's lots of really exciting things going on there, and it's such a fast moving space. Having been at, you know, ERC World Congress in Las Vegas and global executive event over in London, there's a lot of people who are not really fully aware as to how, when, and when not to use those. But I'm very excited about those, what all those things do as tools to help change and elevate the future of work as well. So yeah, I have to say very excited. And obviously very excited for us as a family as well. I mean, for me, I cannot say enough for living in Portugal. I know we didn't get a chance to touch on it too much, but I've absolutely loved every minute since we came over.
That's awesome. What do you love about it? I'm curious, like as we sort of wrap up, I usually like to ask fun, but what are you loving right now about living in Portugal?
I'm loving the fact that I've lived in so many different places. I've traveled around the world, but the first time in my life, I really, really, really feel home. It's hard to describe, you know, multifaceted reasons. It's the people, it's, you know, the culture, it's the being by the beach. It's, your kids being so happy. The school is fantastic. So much love. The weather, just so many different reasons. Hard to explain. But the community here is wonderful.
Wow. I've never been, but I really, really want to go now.
Well, if you make it, just feel free to let me know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. John, thank you so much. This has been really interesting. And, you know, I think we can go on for a long, long time, especially around, you know, where some thoughts are on digital nomad visa and how it may shake out from the corporate hiring standpoint. The reality is we don't know yet, to your point. We know that things are changing. We know that it's being built today. And so as the policies and the strategies are being built, you know, it's really cool to see companies like Work From Anywhere being built alongside that as the tools to implement those strategies and policies. So, yeah, congrats, you know, on the foresight and everything you guys have built so far.
Now, appreciate it, Roman. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and for everyone who tuned in.
Thank you so much for being here. And obrigado, right?
Yeah, de nada, de nada.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. All right. Thank you, everybody, so much. This was really fantastic for me, and I hope it was valuable for you. You know, the only thing I would sort of leave with is this concept of agreeing or believing that remote work and work from anywhere is a trend that's growing. And you know, yes, it's not going to be a lifestyle for everybody. I mean, we need people to build railroads. We need people to be doctors and nurses. We need people to cook and, you know, but there are also millions of people who do not have jobs like that. And frankly, the more we can move them around the world more freely, perhaps the more we can support the people who are working on the ground and working with their hands and, you know, maybe don't want to or can't sort of just live anywhere in the world. We need all the different people kind of coming together. And my hope is that digital nomad visas and other sort of opportunities will give folks the choice. So hope you all have a wonderful weekend ahead. You know, stay safe. If you are inspired by this and want to go live or travel abroad, please go do it and let me know how it goes, you know. In the meantime, have a great weekend, everybody. Peace out. And thank you again for tuning in.